In what appears to be a game of chicken, Governor Youngkin faces off with the General Assembly over the budget. Plus, despite being outnumbered by leftists this year, social conservatives still scored some major victories for life and family. Join us today as we give you an exclusive report on the final outcomes of the 2024 General Assembly. Welcome to Speak Up Virginia, equipping you to speak up on the life, family, and freedom issues that matter most to you. From the Family Foundation, I'm your host, Candy Cushman, with our president, Victoria Cobb. Well, greetings, everybody. Glad to have you with us. Victoria, it seems like just the other day we were talking about the start of session and how for you it often feels like this roller coaster with a lot of escalation and then a big dip and back again. So we finally reach the end and we're all still standing. How are you feeling?
Yeah, I mean, I do feel always like a little like, you know, you also have your like wind blown, you know, because I got your hairs all, you know, I kind of feel a little like that. But I think we're standing in a pretty good place, I would say, relative to where we could be. So
that's a good description.
That fair?
Yeah. Well, we predicted at the outset that left-wing radicals that are in control right now of both chambers of the General Assembly would use this strategy, a fire hose kind of strategy, where they just throw everything at you, because I think they know that makes it more difficult for us to tackle individual bills when everything, the whole kitchen sink, is coming at us. And so that did happen this year. And I think because of that, in a sense, it felt like it was the session of vice, because it just felt like if there was some kind of sin industry or vice to glorify, they were doing it. So it did not matter whether it was shield protections for Planned Parenthood or, you know, gambling in our local convenience stores, you know, marijuana, pot shops on every corner. It didn't matter. They were going to push for it.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely accurate. You know, we knew all along, I think right from the beginning, that our effort to stop bad bills was going to be difficult in the legislature, hard to do within the bodies and in the committees, and that it was probably going to be mostly about a back-end strategy dealing with our governor and getting him to be the backstop, him to be the veto. And as just to put things in perspective, Governor Youngkin did see about 1,000 bills that made it through the process, so he had a lot to review, and they got to his desk, and it is interesting. He signed about 777 of those, so, you know, a fair number, but he amended 116, which is a lot of tweaking. And then, of course, he had actually a veto record, so he vetoed 153 of these bills, so that is a lot.
Yeah. And you keep seeing the media make a big deal out of this, that he has vetoed more than any other governor in our history. But I think, to be fair, we got to look at, he probably had more bad incoming than any other governor, right?
Yeah. I mean, when you have a governor that's the opposite party of the chamber in session, you're going to have a lot of that. I mean, we've had some amazing veto battles in the past, and it was the opposite way around, right? So we had conservatives, we passed, for example, parental consent and partial birth abortion, both passed under conservative legislators and went to Governor Warner, who was very liberal. He vetoed them. We actually overrode both of those vetoes, which is exciting because that takes a lot. But I mean, the bottom line is, it's when it's that dynamic, you should expect a lot of things to be vetoed.
Yeah.
I think that's reasonable.
Well, and like I said, I feel like that they have the strategy of throwing more than ever before.
And Republicans don't always, you know, when it's Republicans in power, they kind of think, well, how much policy can we change? Let's actually give the governor things that we can get through. I don't think they've had the strategy of pound, 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 and make him veto.
Yeah.
I actually just think they think differently, which is a bummer, because we had a lot of stuff we'd like to get through when we had more conservative chambers, and, you know, we got a few things through.
Yeah. All right. Well, today, for all of you, we are going to go over each and every one of those 1,000 bills. No, I'm totally kidding. But obviously, we want to make this easy for you, but help you have a sense of where we landed after session. So we are going to just highlight the things that you care about, the most important things on life and family and parental rights and that kind of thing. And I thought it would be good to really start out on a positive note. So we are going to start out by highlighting the top five victories this session, which actually are a pretty good deal considering all the incoming that we had. So, Victoria, let's just start off with the surprise defeat of physician-assisted suicide.
Yeah, I mean, there's probably nothing bigger that happened in terms of a victory, because while we have beaten back that bill in the past, the Democrats that joined the Republicans to beat it in the past had been taken out of office. So we were looking at a group that was new to this bill from the left, getting pressure from the left. And so we were deeply concerned that this thing was going to get to the governor. And the exciting part about this is we actually defeated it in the legislature, which, as we said earlier, it was hard to defeat anything in this liberal legislature. So that was a big deal.
Yeah, before it even got to his desk.
He didn't even have to look at it. And I think he's happy when he doesn't have to. It's like one less bill I have to deal with. So I think that
is
really...
Just to kind of summarize on that, that was basically putting doctors and insurance companies in the position of prescribing basically poison pills to people that have been diagnosed with a terminal illness, right? Is there anything?
Yeah, and we know how governments have abused that in other places, and just the idea that we're going to become a society where we only look at human life for its utilitarian purpose, you know, that it's the intrinsic value. It's just one more thing where we say life is not intrinsically valued because God has created it and that it is worthy of our respect. So
we can celebrate this, people. That was a big deal. So I thank God for that success. Now, I did want to mention four other victories that we experienced, and that was through the governor veto.
Yes.
And one of the biggest wins, I think, in that category was his veto of the commercialization of marijuana. Let's just let the governor explain his reasoning a little bit. We'll just play that clip.
Cannabis is bad for Virginia. And we see across other states that have had retail markets for a while, a massive increase in adolescent usage, a massive increase in child poisonings. And what that results from is accessibility that is far greater than it would be otherwise. You couple this with the reality that cannabis today is so strong.
All right. He hit on all exactly the right stuff there, how it's not really going to stop the black market, how it really hurts our youth. And I'm just so glad he was strong on that. But it really was a big win, right? Because there was a lot of pressure coming at him on this particular thing.
It's a huge win because any bill that creates revenue is very difficult for politicians. They like the money allows them to do other things. And so there was a lot of pressure that, look, if we do this, you're going to get a cut. The state's going to get a cut of what happens with this market for marijuana. And so I think there was a lot of pressure. Most of the hearings weren't about the health risks. So literally the legislature tried to act like this is just about business and revenue. I mean, we talked about this before. They named the bill something that wasn't even related
economic
to marijuana.
Development,
yeah,
something.
The bill's name wasn't even about marijuana. And so I think for him, he saw it clearly. Like, he saw through the ridiculousness of what was being touted as this is why this bill needs to pass. And you got to remember, and maybe folks don't know this, but when you're in down at the General Assembly, these bills, like marijuana and gambling in particular, they get the high-powered lobbyist firms, the ones that have all the former legislators that are now lobbyists, that are buddies with. These are hard bills to defeat because of just the literal sort of money that goes behind them and who's who and all of that. And so, yeah, we're really proud of Governor Youngkin for just, like, clearly seeing this harms our kids. We're not going to be a part of this.
Yeah, and I think the reason there is so much pressure is because, unfortunately, under Northam, you may remember, they had already taken the first steps toward legalizing personal possession. So there was all this pressure. Well, now we've done that. Now we got to go the whole way and just kind of fast forward, you know, commercialization of pot shop on every corner. And so what I'm wondering, Victoria, is the future for this? Because since we still have that first step there, you know, with people being able to have personal possession, are we just going to be continually every year under pressure for commercialization? Or is there any way to reverse this so we can just cut that off at the root?
Boy, I hope so. I look at Oregon and I have hope, right? So that was a state that passed, I mean, literally decriminalized small amounts of heroin and fentanyl, right?
Okay.
So this was like horrible stuff. And that legislature this year actually rolled that back and said, okay, that was a bad idea what we did a couple years ago. So I'm trying
to
take hope. Now, this is not heroin and fentanyl.
Yeah,
this is weed.
But that does give me
hope. Yeah, and I gotta think there's a few people that are like, wow. I mean, I walked into a hospital parking lot the other day and smelled weed everywhere. And I just sat there and thought, like, I'm trying to go get healthy and you're like making me, you know what I'm saying? So I hope that the average person is going, wow, what has this done to our Commonwealth? And maybe we'll get back to a sense of like.
I did not know that about Oregon. So that actually
gives
me some help.
Yes.
If Oregon can do it,
we can do it.
All right. On to another veto victory. And I did want to mention a win on parental rights and the whole sexually explicit book issue. Now, a lot of you may remember that we covered this at our Mama Bear Day press conference at the Capitol, where we featured parents that were concerned about their right to weigh in on sexually explicit books being put in front of their kindergartner, you know, their elementary school kid, and even middle school. Some of these books are terrible with pedophilia and things like that in it, being glorified. And they wanted the right to weigh in on, no, my child shouldn't be exposed to this in the taxpayer-funded school. So that did come up in a bill. And before we get into that, I just want to let you hear from one of our Hanover moms that spoke at that press conference, Becca.
Recently in Hanover County, parents became aware of dozens of sexually explicit books found in school libraries. We're talking about stories entirely focused on sexual experimentation, replete with pornographic details and illustrations. Some include illicit drug abuse. Many are peppered with obscene profanity and derogatory terms. These texts are so vulgar, they're not permitted to be read aloud at school board meetings, yet kids are encouraged to check them out at school. Why are we even arguing about this? These books clearly don't line up with the standards of excellence and enrichment imagined for students. Obscene pornographic material should not be delivered to minors for any purpose and has no place in taxpayer-funded public schools. I'm grateful our school board listened to parents instead of ignoring them like so many others do, and updated its policy in a manner that safeguards all kids going forward. Which brings me to my final point. I understand a bill is moving through the House and Senate, and if passed, would codify language that basically ties the hands of school boards from being able to address parents' concerns on this issue. Hypersexualized content ought not be pushed on kids in school, and as parents, we have a constitutionally protected right to oversee the care and education of our own children.
Now, you heard Becca just reference how this bill that was going through would have actually had a chilling effect on school boards' ability to respond to parents bringing up the concerns about sexually explicit books. Victoria, tell us where we landed with that.
Yeah, we're super pleased that the governor stepped in and vetoed this bill. And really, he's just been so strong on parental rights, right? This has just been his hallmark. I think this is what he'll be known for. You know, we think about the governor having a legacy. Honestly, I think it will be parental rights that is his legacy. So I'm so thrilled that he did this. And I think he just understood, look, parents are at these school boards. They're making their voices heard. To shut them down through the state legislature is just wrong. That they want to battle this with their local school boards. It should be a local decision of how we get parents in charge of what's the content that their kids are going to have to absorb in the schools.
Yeah, I think it's significant that he listened to moms like Becca, yeah, to their voices and responded. Does this have any relevance, or is it significant in other reasons besides him just listening to parents as far as setting some kind of precedent for school boards? Or,
well, I hope school boards will listen. I hope they will realize that, the governor got elected on this. This is popular across Virginia. So I hope this just continues to reinforce, yeah, to them that the right side of this issue is to be on the side of the parents that want to protect the innocence of their children.
Okay, last but not least, I did also, Victoria, want you to touch on these issues having to do with the exploitation of women and abortion, and that also has to do with a couple of vetoes. Tell us about that.
Yeah, we were very pleased to see him veto what we call shield laws, which is this idea that we're going to shield abortionists from any kind of consequence for their actions, even when they are Virginia abortionists stepping into other states and actually violating the law of other states. So really where this comes down is chemical abortion. We've talked about this before, where you have either doctors or pharmacists playing a role in delivering pills into a state that has banned it. And so these laws would have either allowed, not allowed extradition, so the Texas governor couldn't deal with somebody, or they would have had zero, said there's going to be no consequence on your Virginia medical license if you illegally, yeah, participate in medicine somewhere else.
And yeah, so, like if someone brings a teen in from one of those states where it's banned or restricted and a Virginia doctor messes up a teen girl trying to do an abortion on her, no accountability. I did feel like this was like a Planned Parenthood doctor shield law.
Oh, it's like a dream law for an industry that wants absolutely no accountability, absolutely no transparency, no ability to step in. We don't do that with any industry. It's somehow politics gets in here, and abortion, we think we're going to literally practice medicine outside the scope of any any accountability, any oversight. And that not just only harms the unborn child, that harms the women. And so I was incredibly pleased that the governor just said, we're not doing this here. No
big
way.
Victory there. Yep. Now tell us about Rent a Womb. W-O-M-B, Rent a Womb.
Yes. We also were very pleased to see him veto the commercialized surrogacy process that was put into a bill that basically would have said, we are going to create a market around someone's womb, someone vulnerable, someone who obviously, you know, the lure of I need money is going to sell their most valuable, their own precious place to raise their own children. And so we just absolutely stood against this and were pleased that the governor saw that for what it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, so just to summarize here, we're going to flash an image on the screen for you summarizing the top five victories, but I'm just going to kind of run through them real quick. So defeated, before it went to the governor's desk, physician-assisted suicide. Vetoed pot shop on every corner. Vetoed efforts to prevent school boards from being able to fully respond to parents on sexually explicit books. Veto Rent-A-Womb. Veto shield laws for abortionists. So, you know, Victoria, I know it's been sobering, the amount of bad stuff we've been seeing exalted and pushing through, but I think people need to take heart that even in that environment, we were still able to block these things.
Yeah, I think it's a great reminder to people that the work that they did to get this governor elected paid off, right? So, people went out and they shared with their friends, look, if we're going to have any kind of backstop, we need a conservative governor. And I think they're getting the reward of that because, boy, I mean, we'd have a very different Commonwealth if those bills were not vetoed.
Yeah. All right. Now, moving out of the veto category, I also wanted to spend a little time today talking about another action that the governor took, and that was amending bad bills. Because when they get to his desk, those 1,000 bills, he has basically three choices. He can sign the bill, he can veto it, or he can amend it. And so he's done that. The deadline passed for that. He's taken all these actions. And so we're going to talk about a couple of bills here that really, we were very concerned about, and he made some amendments to them. So one bill that fell into that category was also addressed by the parents at Mama Bear Day, and that was this whole issue of parents being notified when a drug overdose happens on their kid's campus. And the reason this issue really got high profile, got national attention, is because, once again, Loudoun County was dropping the ball. I mean, I'm sorry to say it, but once again, we see that, and they had something like 10 overdoses of students on their campuses, and it literally took them about as much as 20 days to notify parents that this was happening on their child's campus. So you can imagine, as a parent, you know, if there's a dangerous drug being passed around, you got 10 overdoses happening, hello, I think I would want to know that as a mom and also have the chance to talk to my kid about it. But no, they're waiting 20 days. And so that's why this legislation started going forward on it. Let's just watch a clip from the Loudoun controversy.
New tonight, a troubling trend of student overdoses in Loudoun County has that school system and its leader under fire tonight.
So the superintendent is now offering a whole timeline of what happened and responding to the governor's criticism.
Yeah, our Northern Virginia Bureau reporter Max Marcilla is at the Loudoun County School headquarters.
We're going to learn from this moment.
Loudoun County Schools is back in the headlines, this time with a new superintendent as it gets set to welcome an entirely new school board. Here's what happened. On Halloween, the Loudoun County Sheriff announced that 7 Parkview High School students had overdosed on opioids in 3 weeks, and immediately criticism over why the school district had not informed parents earlier.
That's one of the biggest concerns that the community had.
The Loudoun County School Board didn't decide it was important enough to tell parents.
Governor Glenn Youngkin campaigned on the issue, which was revealed just days before a critical election, and he issued an executive order requiring schools to tell parents of school-related overdoses.
Okay, so Victoria, this whole thing really upset a lot of parents. I was hearing about this from a lot of parents in our speak-up teams because they didn't like the whole 20-day thing. They just thought that was outrageous. Tell us where this issue ended up.
Yeah, so there were basically the House and the Senate had 2 different versions of this bill, and one was just a weaker version. It just basically said, like, we're going to create some regulations. And really, those regulations could have been anything. Like, we'll tell kids something. We'll tell parents something about these situations. But it wasn't, there were no specified details of what a parent could be guaranteed those guidelines would include. And the other version was much stronger. It said, okay, within 24 hours, we're going to tell a parent, you know, we're going to actually include what kind of drug is the problem, what, you know, just the basics. No one needs to know which kids these are. They need to know what the circumstances are, because if a parent knows about that, they're going to be more likely to remember, hey, I should have that drug conversation with my kid tonight at dinner. Like, yeah. I should just refresh on what hopefully we've been talking to them all along about. And so the weaker bill is the one that got to the governor's desk. And so we're really pleased. We put some pressure on him to tighten that up and bring it back to a much stronger version. And he did that. So now the bill that they're looking at, they go back for reconvened session. They've got to either agree with the governor's amendments or reject them. But what they're looking at is a much stronger parental rights bill.
Okay. So on the day that this is airing for the first time, April 17th, that happens to be the day that the General Assembly considers all these governor actions. So it is possible that you may already have news out by the time you hear this about whether they accepted or rejected that amendment, right?
Yes, and I want to remind people, if they reject amendments, so if they say, no, we want the weaker version, we're going to reject your amendments, the governor then has a choice to veto it completely so that nothing becomes law, or to sign it. So okay. So we're really hoping that they will agree with these amendments.
All right, I'm going to ask for your predictions about that a little bit later. But first, I want to talk about another amendment that he made, and that has to do with slot machines. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so there was a lot of pressure on the governor around this issue. We put a lot of pressure to ask him to just veto the bill. We really just didn't want to see these things at all. And the other side put a lot of pressure to pass it as is, which was a terrible bill. And the original starting bill would have legalized unprecedented expansion of gambling into every neighborhood. I mean, it was, you know, an insane amount of machines. They were allowed to be wherever. There weren't the original, the bill that went to the governor, really, you couldn't even have a locality say, we don't want them here in our, you know, just decide for themselves. And so we're really pleased. So his amendments, there was a variety, because this is a complicated issue, but basically, the easiest things that you should know that got changed in his amendments were that it banned it within 35 miles of a radius around where there are other gambling forms, so around a casino or around a racetrack. So it's sort of like, if we already have gambling in this area, we're not going to have the slot machines as well. Now, many of us would go, okay, well, that's nice. You protected the other gambling interests. I have no interest in whether a casino has to compete with other gambling. I just want them all gone, you know?
Ironically, now I have an interest whether there's a casino, because now I want to know.
Now you want to know, are you going to also get slot machines in your neighborhood?
If Petersburg gets a casino, then is Richmond kind of protected
then
from slot machines?
35-mile radius from, yes, because Petersburg did have an approved casino happen in this whole mess of this session. So, yes, that's a good question. So you're going to start paying attention to where else there's gambling in your area. But it also allowed communities, as a community, to come together, and if they get 5,000 signatures or a percentage of voters, they can then basically go and launch a referendum and at the ballot box decide, we don't want them here. And that was an important feature.
Yeah, because even then, sadly, so it would just be thrust on your community, but your community would have to be proactive.
Right,
and
yes. So unfortunately, you have to.
And say, we need to collect 5,000 signatures because we don't want this.
Yes, correct. So these were some big changes. It really does limit significantly how many machines, how much money is made off this whole thing. And he increased the state cut of profits out of these things. So it's like, if we're going to have them, we're going to take more of the profits. So there was some changes made there, and, you know, we'll have to see how those chips roll.
All right. Well, like we said, by the time you hear this, Democrats may have rejected this amendment, which is why we would prefer a veto, because a veto requires 2/3 in each chamber to overrule, and they don't have that. So all the vetoes are I'm pretty sure most of the vetoes are going to be intact. That's going to be a win. But the amendment could very well be rejected. Do they have enough to reject, you think, these amendments?
I think if the Democrats lock together and they say, we absolutely think this waters down how much we were hoping these slot machines were everywhere. I mean, I don't even understand the aspiration around this bill. But nevertheless, if they lock up, you know, and say, we're all going to vote together and we're going to reject these amendments, then it'll go back to the governor and he could then veto. So if that happens, we're going to push real hard that he just veto the thing. Say, look, it wasn't what you wanted. It wasn't what we wanted. Let's just kill it.
Do you feel safe enough to make any predictions on these bills?
I'm glad that he made it so that they're really unhappy, at least, because I think it's good that they're really unhappy.
When you say they're really unhappy, what
they
do you
wanted a lot more in the slot. This does restrict the amount of slot machines a lot, and they are really unhappy about that. And so the question is, do they think some is better than none? Right. This is the question in all legislation.
There is a real threat that he would veto it if.
A real threat. I think there's a real threat. So.
All right. I hope that's motivating.
I hope so.
All right, let's talk about this dramatic budget battle that has been in the media the entire time, pretty much. And I've even seen headlines comparing it to a huge game of chicken between the governor and the General Assembly. Would you agree with that kind of assessment?
Oh, yeah, no question. It was kind of fun watching it play out over, I was going to say Twitter, but over X,
yeah.
You know, between Senator Lucas and Governor Youngkin. And yeah, it's been entertaining, but we actually need good policy in Virginia, not just good entertainment. So
right.
That's the only thing that's a little
alarming.
Yeah,
it's not a reality show.
Right,
TV
right.
Game. Yeah, it actually has impact. But I guess the good news for us is that the leftists, I think, well overplayed their hand, which resulted in tough vetoes with marijuana and all things like that. But also, it was kind of interesting because everyone was saying, well, it's just unprecedented for the governor to veto a budget. And actually, I should back up and say the reason this budget was so bad is because it ignored any of his efforts to balance things out with tax cuts. Because as he's pointed out, we have a lot of money floating around in the coffers right now. They don't need to take more from us. But they did try to take more from us. And so, you know, they were then trying to threaten, well, no governor has ever vetoed an entire budget like this in Virginia before, and it's unprecedented, can't do that. So he came back and with 230-something vetoes, right? Over 200 at least.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was smart of him to say—
I mean, I said vetoes.
Amendments.
Amendments. Over 200 amendments, yeah.
Yeah, but I think it was smart of him to go, look, you know, this is a budget we're all going to have to come together and live with, and you guys really did try to raise taxes in this, and you didn't balance them out with cuts. So he went in there, but he also did some things we care about, and I think it's really important to note, for example, that they did not include in the budget the Hyde Amendment, which is something that has been in most of our budgets over decades and decades. And the concept there is that we don't want anything in this budget to force tax dollars to pay for abortion, except in very rare cases. And so we're glad to see that he put that back in there. I mean, they're going to hate that, you know.
I mean, am I wrong? Don't the polls show that most people do not want their taxpayer dollars to fund abortion, even with people on these ballots saying, don't take away my right to have an abortion as a backup, still, they don't necessarily want taxpayer dollars paid for. Am I wrong about that?
Yes, no, you are absolutely correct. That is what the polling shows. It is just that the reality of politics is that you have people that have been elected in parties where Planned Parenthood has been the bulk of the funding, and so they want to make sure that they're getting Planned Parenthood their payback, you know? They want to give back, and so they're doing it with our tax dollars. And
I'm
glad he put it back in. That is one of the Family Foundation's most historic, constant veto battle we have every year is over what this language is it in there, and is it tight enough, and round we go. Literally every veto session we battle this.
So I am encouraged that he put that in there. All right, so just to summarize, you know, they put forward this, as he put it, backwards budget, regressive, and then it would be a tight spot for him to have to veto the entire thing. So he came back with 200-something amendments to the budget. Now they're kind of squalling about that. And so, Victoria, I'm going to ask you for another prediction, just what your thoughts are, because this could be interesting, because if they reject those budgets, he could be forced into vetoing the entire budget. Or do you think we might see a battle going into June here over the budget?
There's a lot of complicated strategy that really would probably bore people if I tried to outline it. But I think it would be very hard for him to veto it, because they could put him up in a wall where they sit, where he gets a budget back that is literally June 30th, and the government either shuts down or he puts what they want in session. So it's real dicey.
Oh,
I mean, he does not want to be put in the position of government shutdown or agree to this. And that's, he's got to avoid, he's got to get his best budget, but not get in that situation, because government shutdowns typically are pretty widely disliked by, and you know, Virginia, we have so much government that means so many people are affected. So
we have to have a budget.
Right.
It's not an option to have zero budgets.
Correct.
So something has to exist.
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, we see this in Congress, you know, these fights over shutdowns, so.
Well, obviously, there is a lot to be thankful here, even in the midst of all the bad things we were fighting and the dark things that we still are up against in the state. There's still a lot to be thankful for. But I would be remiss if we did not mention a couple of major disappointments that happened. Of course, there's still a lot of people still dealing with the major disappointment over the governor signing the same-sex marriage law. Did you want to say anything else about that?
I just say I hear from somebody every day that is so devastated by that, just that we would now have in our law, in the actual code, that same-sex marriage is fine. And, you know, that's going to hurt for a long time. And it's deeply disappointing. So there's not much more that can be said about that other than we appreciate those who did let Governor Youngkin know that they were disappointed, because that helps them do the right thing in future. Like, it's not trying to chastise someone. It's just trying to go, look, we want to make sure you know that this mattered to us. And, you know, because he looks at lots of things that are in similar swath. I mean, they're similar. I mean, we were worried, for example, that if when the same-sex marriage bill was signed, what would he do with the bullying bill? Because that had LGBT wording in it. And he did the right thing. He actually took out the wording. We didn't mention that bill. But, you know, he took out the bad LGBT wording. So I think our response helped him make good decisions on other things.
All right. Well, how would you wrap up this year's session overall, and maybe a couple of takeaways before we head out here?
I just start with God is good. We could be in a terrible place at the end of this session, and we have a governor that did mostly the right things, and we are really grateful for that. We went through 2 years where we had liberals top to bottom, governor all the way down, and we saw everything they put into our code, and it has changed our lives in not a good way. And so I think we should be very thankful. And it shows that the work that people put in, both on the election side and then this year talking to their legislators, showing up at Mama Bear, it shows that that work pays off, that we can get something done when the church is the voice, when we are the ones inserting just the clear, sound advice to our elected officials. So,
all right. Keep up the fight, people. Your voice matters. Thank you for joining us today. Remember, it helps when you can share the Speak Up Virginia playlist to get the word out to more people what's really going on. And if you're on audio only, Spotify, Apple, give us that 5-star review if you like what you hear, because that also helps get the word out. And remember, we are stronger when we speak together.